When I first came to to meditation practice, actually, my first experience with meditation as a teenager was with transcendental meditation in college, when they were introducing that in colleges and campuses throughout the 70s and 80s. So that was a mantra, a secret mantra, which felt all very spiritual. I didn't have a clue what it meant, but it, you know, for a few seconds it gave me the opportunity to sit still and muster my spiritual aspirations, and for a few moments to come into presence. And probably there was a lot of other imagination going on as well. But it was a beginning. And when I came into this tradition of practice, which does talk a lot about the breath as a primary object of meditation, I just so wasn't interested in the breath. It seemed so uninteresting to me. I didn't pay much attention to it. I wanted the real guts of the wisdom tradition. I wanted to watch the mind, to understand the mind. The breath was, you know, something that wasn't particularly interesting to me, even though my teachers were teaching breath meditation. It was very hard to get interest in it because the mind was so active. And yet now, you know, some 30 years on, I find the breath such a wonderful tool, such a wonderful experience, such a wonderful meditation, not just an object, but a meditation experience. The breath tells us so much about what's going on in this body and mind. The breath provides, the breath in some sense to me is like a meditation buddy, a companion, a spirit guide that helps me settle into my body. And as I settle into the body, into this present moment, the breath continues to indicate to me what's happening in this body mind, just through the different changes of the breath. Even if thought takes me away for a while, breath brings me back. I've been working with breath as a meditation object amongst many other objects for quite some time. And some days it's still really challenging. You know, if it's been a busy day, if it's been a busy week or year, if there's been a lot going on, or if there's any conflict you've been involved in, the body-mind is stirred up, you know. But the breath, if you cultivate a relationship with your breath, getting to know it, it's something that can bring you back into the present moment. And this is really what all, or many meditation objects are about, developing full conscious presence here and now, coming into the present in order to see clearly what's going on in this experience of being human in this body mind. Because a lot of our experience of being human, I don't know about you, but for me it's a lot of feeling pushed and pulled by the various forces inside and outside. The various necessities of life, the body, life's circumstances push and pull us a lot. And so the breath is something that is continually with us. As I had an opportunity just to very briefly sit in on Sharon Salzberg's talk for just 20 minutes at Spirit Rock a few days ago. And she was quoting an old teacher of hers, saying the wonder of the breath is it's, as a meditation object, is it's so portable. You know, you don't have to carry a lot of gear with you and set yourself up. It's like wherever you are, there is the breath. You know, and it's also something that in our meditation tradition, but I believe in any line of spiritual practice, it's something that can help us come into direct contact with the very essence of our being. It can help us on one level just come out of stress. I think there's a lot of new interest in meditation in the last 5 or 10 years because of the popularizing of mindfulness, and mindfulness often uses the breath as one object of meditation. So a lot of people come just looking for that way to just de-stress a little bit. You know, life has become so stressful, so many symptoms of stress, just something to help turn down the volume or still things a little bit, which is wonderful. And, you know, if that's all one is seeking, it's still wonderful because one gains access to a lot more subliminally. Our conscious intention, maybe just to de-stress a little, but subliminally what's happening is we're coming into presence, into recognizing reality, the reality of this body-mind, however we experience it. You know, reality isn't something that someone else has got and I haven't. Reality is happening, unfolding here and now in this body and mind, in each of us. And this is the kind of reality the Buddha was encouraging his students and disciples to awaken to. The simple, sometimes not so simple, reality of this body-mind in the way we experience it. So it's not someone else who's got the wisdom. It's not someone else who's got the tricks or the tips. The Buddha kept pointing us back to our own body-mind to really begin to wake up to what's happening here and now. So he gave us tools and frameworks to begin to reflect on just this, something as simple as the breath. So the breath, we can talk about breath meditation, and many of you, I'm sure, if not all of you, have experienced moments of settling, if not more than moments, but just intention to witness a breath. It may just be one in breath and one out breath. But something happens, something aligns, the mind stills for a moment, and maybe there's more moments that come. Just this stilling of the body-mind is the beginning of the settling of the movement of thoughts, the movement of emotions, the various emotions of the heart, mind. It's not that we want to try to stop these things altogether, but we want to begin to develop a way we can get some clarity on what's happening. So the breath becomes, if we cultivate it, becomes something a bit like an anchor for a little boat that's bobbing on the ocean. You know, in those busy days or stressful times, it's like the storm that comes through and it's really whipping up waves and the boat's really getting tossed around. But if we can stay in contact with our breath, no matter how it feels, it doesn't have to feel peaceful, but if we can stay in contact with our breath and the body, it's like an anchor that keeps us present in this moment. And with that presence, we can know, this knowing quality of the mind. Awareness itself is what the Buddha said, it's like it's something that's already present, but like the breath, we overlook it. We've never been taught to develop it. It's like a mental faculty that we've overlooked, that hasn't been valued in our society, this quality of knowing, of awareness itself. It's possible to recognize that when we still for a moment, and to cultivate or develop that, if we're going to call it a bit of a mental muscle. It's a faculty of mind that needs cultivating. So the more we can come into the present moment, be with the body, be with the breath, recognize the thoughts coming and going, there's emotions coming and going, you're settling your mind into the one who knows, or that which knows what's happening. It may seem like a subtle shift, but actually it's a major shift out of just being moved by that energy and thinking, I am this energy, whether it's physical, mental or emotional, coming out of being buffeted by that to just knowing it, even momentarily. Ah, there is this. There's that powerful thought again. There's that dreadful fear again. There's that pain in the body. Where do I feel that? How do I feel that? This kind of inquiry, we can develop this inquiry to begin to cultivate this knowing awareness, and the breath becomes something that helps us stay present and come back, and a bit of a barometer for what's going on. Because what happens when we feel anxious or fearful, for example, anxiety or fearful thought comes in? Check your breath. Usually it's either stopped or frozen or become very shallow. Yeah? Sometimes what's happened for me over the years, my breath and body tell me what's going on in the heart mind before I cognize it. Because I've become so familiar with what the breath is doing, it's like, oh, is there fear here? You know, kind of short, stopped breath, and it's like, oh, what's happening? When you have that recognition in the moment and the presence, now you've got choice how to be with this. Huh. For me, again, over the years of practice, the choice becomes one of wholesomeness. What's most wholesome here? Relax this body mind. How does one relax? One learns, you know, over time, but very quickly, what relaxes this body mind. And so just a little shift, and then the nervous system shifts into another gear. Relax. So you're recognizing habitual patterns, mental patterns, habitual emotional patterns, which key into habitual biological, physiological responses. All of this we become aware of due to just noticing the breath. It builds our intuitive awareness, it builds the clarity of mind, and it builds the opportunity for skillful response. And it also becomes something that we can witness. Well, what happens if I do this? What happens if I do that? So you have this presence of mind to be able to witness cause and effect. How am I, say there's a different kind of emotion arises, you're in at work, or there's a difficult relationship, and suddenly you're in front of this person that there's been problems with, and maybe a bit of anger catches the heart. You know, it's that mindfulness, and particularly mindfulness of breath, that tells you, oh, something's going on here. You know, I feel the tightness in the chest, you know, tightness in the gut, you know, a lump in the throat, maybe the eyes flare slightly. All these physiological signs connected with breath and the body are telling you something's been triggered. So it gives you this opportunity to be, how is that? How am I with that? Can I relax around that? What do I need right now? Whereas if we're not aware of all of those triggers arising, we tend again to get caught up in just the habitual response. So whatever is the default for any one of us will be the most dominant default response. And we all fall into that regularly when mindfulness lapses, because we're not perfectly mindful all of the time. So we can reflect on that afterwards. How was that? You know, maybe where we feel safer or more at ease in a natural environment or our home environment. We can reflect, you know, what happened there? So this opportunity for inquiry and observing, using this very body-mind as the barometer, as the laboratory, as that which is showing us both the conditions, conditionality of body-mind, as we move in and out of different conditions and circumstances in our life, we're constantly responding to different things. But if we can cultivate this mindfulness of body, mindfulness of breath, moving with us through every circumstance of life, we're gaining more information and we're gaining the opportunity of choice. There is choice when we have mindfulness in the present moment. Even what seems like a split second internally can be a very spacious moment of choosing how to respond. But without mindfulness, it's just habit. We're driven by habit or caught up in, sometimes even caught up in the group response, you know, without really knowing what's happening. So this breath has become, for me, a wonderful friend, and I'll often teach, and I would never have conceived of that in the early days of practice, that the breath is like a friend that leads me into the forest of my own heart in whatever's happening. It's like a guide, leads me in. But what also, having trained in meditation and contemplation, the breath has become something now that can help bring more tranquility as well. Really knowing how to be with the breath. And that doesn't mean that you have to be conscious of every breath, every in and out breath for the whole 30 minutes of the meditation, because the mind will be distracted with sounds or thoughts. But to know how to come back, to know that the breath is always here, or to remember to ask, where is the breath, when we get pulled into a fantasy of the future or a recollection of the past. There's nothing wrong with that, but the benefit and the intention of meditation is to wake up out of that, because all of that's about habit, all of that's about drifting, all of that's about falling slightly asleep, you know. And this type of meditation is all about waking up. But ultimately it's finding that balance of restfulness, of tranquility with the breath, but with full awareness. It's a real balance. And sometimes, you know, for myself as well, it feels more like a maintenance thing, you know, just exercising the breath. But sometimes, and you can't predict it, sometimes you might sit down and then you go straight in to this tranquility with deep awareness. Sometimes that might only come after, you know, a long time of sitting or being in retreat, but sometimes it comes upon you at the least expected moment. And this is where, you know, the Buddha has many instructions about using how to use awareness of the breath to settle, to still the movement of the mind to such a degree and refine the awareness, or I mean, it's not really refining the awareness, but when the mind stills and there's the knowing, you're still with the presence, then that awareness seems to expand. And so it sees so much more of what the reality is of this body mind, and it kind of blows your ideas out of the water. You think, I am this body, and the body changes shape completely. Some might disappear completely in the depths of still meditation. You may perceive it merely as energy. Or not, it might become so refined. There's even the possibility of moving into the refinement of what's called the formless realms beyond materiality. It's not anywhere out there, it's just the deepening subtlety of reading this very heart mind, the quality of, some people call it consciousness itself. But the very, very reality of being, the basis of being, which is getting to the truth of who you really are. And at this level, if there's clear awareness, there's this insight, there's this understanding, there's this natural wisdom that arises. And the Buddha has wonderful metaphors of describing, say, the process of tranquility and insight. And one of them is comparing the mind to a pool or a lake or a body of water. When it's stirred up, when the wind stirs it up, or if animals are playing in the water, it's churned up. You can't really see through the water because there's waves and ripples and reflections from the sun. But when that body of water stills, when there's no external forces of wind or things stirring up the water, the silt settles. And then someone with keen eyesight can look into that body of water and see what's there. They can see the fissures, they can see the bottom of the bed of the rocks, can see the weed, can even see the reflections of still reflection of what's around the lake. So this is a metaphor for the clarity that can come just quite naturally. You can see the knowing quality, the awareness of the mind sees naturally exactly what's there, because nothing is disturbing the mind. Mind and heart, we interchange these words. Because it's not the brain, it's not the head. So I think this is a wonderful metaphor, because often spiritual practice, we somehow subtly conceive that the truth is out there. I'm it's not kind of where I'm at. It's something out there I've got to discover. Actually, it's in here. It's the truth of your very being. We just have to see it clearly and understand it from within. For this wisdom, this insight to arise and clarify. Well, it clarifies all of one's questions ultimately about who am I, the existential nature of being, the origin of stress, which is the whole point of the Buddha's teaching. I teach about suffering and the end of suffering, he said. Which is a lot, it's a big subject. Right? Or one teacher translates it as stress, which is quite a modern take. Because suffering is not just pain or really difficult suffering. This word dukkha, it takes in the whole spectrum from mild agitation or unsatisfactoriness, mild unease, all the way to the deepest despair, or the very painful bodily sensations. This word dukkha is kind of an umbrella term for all of that. So when the Buddha was teaching about the goal of this practice of full awakening, full enlightenment, it's articulated as the path to the end of suffering, the path to the end of dukkha, to the cessation of dukkha. And this is articulated in what's called the Four Noble Truths. The first one being the truth of dukkha, the truth of suffering. This is a reality that we experience. When the mind has enough stillness, and enough knowing faculty, enough ripened wisdom, the possibility is for insight into these Four Noble Truths, which finishes the whole game, which clears up the mess of dukkha and brings about the cessation of dukkha. So it's probably a good space for me to throw the ball to Willa to take it into that direction if she so wishes.
Yeah, so continuing with that, the sense of what are we doing here. You know, the Buddha said he only taught one thing, dukkha, or suffering, stress, and the end of stress. Yeah. So this is the Four Noble Truths, and the practice of breath meditation sits within this. You know, that the practice of meditation, the sense of awareness of the breath, it sits within the realization of the Four Noble Truths. And I don't know about you, but I find it really helpful to keep remembering that, to keep remembering that this teaching we were given on the Four Noble Truths was given out of compassion. So we pick up this practice, we pick up awareness of the breath with the way it was given. So we pick it up with compassion for this experience here and for our relationship with the world around us. So here am I breathing, here am I attuning to this direct experience, and it you know, how is it if it has this quality? It's not about something needing to be different, but it's about with all the welcome, all the gentleness, with all the heartfulness we're capable of actually coming here. And the breath is one of the most helpful anchors, as Jitendra has been explaining, because it gives us so much information. It gives information about what's happening for us emotionally, physically, how we're actually experiencing and relating to the world. So it's worth cultivating the capacity to notice, to be able to settle with, to actually be able to feel what the breath does in the body. And it's not an idea, is it? We can have an idea, the breath comes in, the breath goes out, but actually when we attune, it's not like that at all. What is breathing? What is body? So the encouragement is to know these things really directly. Breathing, what's it like? And what happens for us when we really start to attune? When we're really with this process, this rippling of sensation, the movement of life, which is breathing, isn't it? That things come, things go, and we have developed the muscle, the capacity to actually be there, to know it. There's a lovely sutta given to Meghia, given to a practitioner who was looking after the Buddha, but rather than staying attending to him, he requests endlessly to be able to go off and practice meditation in the forest. And so eventually the Buddha agrees, and this young fellow goes off and spends the afternoon practicing meditation, but with the mind completely overrun with chaotic thoughts, frustration, ill will, probably longing for food, just the mind completely in this complete turmoil. So he returns to the Buddha and says, "Lord, it is marvelous. Here was I, so wanting to practice, but my mind, all this stuff was going on." And the Buddha responds and says, "Well, there are five things that conduce to the ripening of the heart. When the heart is not fully realized, five things are helpful. And there are things listed within that, and one is good friends, that we come together, we feel ourselves in a community of practice, because this is one of the primary things, the sense of sangha, that gives enough heartfulness to actually be present to the turbulence we can feel. Yeah, that, energetically, how much easier it is to sit at Sims than it probably is to sit at home. Do you notice? So what's that about? So just noticing, and Buddha's saying, well, actually, good friends are really helpful. And he goes through in this, the sense of ethical living is really critical for the release of the heart when it's not yet fully ripened. And then there's talk. We talk on practice, on living well, on living generously. I'm really starting to penetrate to the truth of the way things are. These things really help. So these are things that are already happening for us all, aren't they? And the next thing is that we really attune to cultivating what is wholesome and putting down what is unwholesome. The fifth thing is that we're really practicing, recognizing anicca, the arising and passing of things. Now, when we're sitting in meditation, we've also got all these things happening, haven't we? In the sense that here we are, we've got this community around us, and then as we're sitting in meditation, and the intention is to stay with the breathing, then when the little resentful thoughts start coming, oh, they did this and they did that, the determination really is that we just quietly put that down and we come back to the breath. We put down what is unwholesome and we come back to what is wholesome. And in a 30-minute meditation session, we may have actually done this 100 times. Put down proliferations, put down the worry, put down the planning, put down all of it and just come back to rest with the breath. So this is the right effort of the Eightfold Path. This is the effort that the Buddha's pointing to that really starts to free us up. That every time we come back to the breath, we get more capacity to do that. We're building these muscles. And any of you who've done any fitness training know that it's more powerful to do thousands of small repetitions and a couple of big lifts in terms of the building of muscles. So this is what we're doing. We're building the muscle, the capacity, the willingness, the understanding that every time we come back into presence, it gets easier. We get more capacity to actually just be here. So, and I find this really helpful. It keeps me with the willingness. Every time I notice the mind is somewhere thinking about something else, say, hey, come here, just be here, feel the breath, because this process so ripens. And a little image, Jitendra was talking about the beautiful images of the Buddha. One of the images I use all the time is this one of, he said, drop by drop the water jar builds. Do not think any good deed is of little worth. So, in India you had these beautiful big water jars, and it's a metaphor for, every time we put down what's unwholesome, cultivate what is wholesome, it's a drop into the water jar. And slowly it fills, and we have the capacity where it just overflows with insight. The mind becomes ripened. As the Buddha says to this young fellow who just goes off. And this other quality, this fifth one he referred to was really starting to notice the arising and passing of things. And this is what we're doing every moment with the breath. We're recognizing that something comes and it passes, it goes. This is natural. And the breath, of course, as it is with the breath, so it is with everything. But it's an easier thing to see this with. So it's a powerful vehicle for insight. The more deeply we actually relax into this experience of the arising and passing of things, of anicca, the Buddha says, well, this really ripens into profound insight into the way things are, into the kind of not fixed, not the not self, the sense of not being a kind of fixed and permanent person, this terribly entrapping view we can have had. This starts to open up and free up. So this painful conceit we start to realize was a complete misapprehension. And the mind is released out of it and comes into experience of, in the sutta, he says, into nibbana, to the complete release out of suffering. And this is happening with the breath. It's a very lovely object because it's completely portable. And in any moment, every moment of the breath, the same depth of insight and experience is possible. It's not delayed in time. We're just here. We're feeling this reality. So it's wow. This is extraordinary. We can just be here, fully present, letting the awareness rest on this lovely experience of the rippling of the breath. And we can live our lives. We can be doing the dishes, we can be driving the car, we can be talking with our friends, breathing is happening. While we're alive, it never forsakes us, so we always can have this as an underlying place our awareness is resting. And it really fruits. And to pick up on the metaphor of the lake Jitendra referred to, Lumpur Cha also used the lake metaphor and said, well, if the mind becomes like a still forest pool, all kinds of rare and precious animals will come to drink at it. And you will have had these experiences, I'm sure, whether in meditation or sitting by the sea or out in this beautiful forest around here, where you're just here, the mind is tranquil, clear. You can come out of fragmentation and conflict and distress. We're just present. And then all of a sudden, insights start arising. It may be even, pragmatic, practical thing of, actually, that's how that cupboard could fit together. It's a bit like all the obscuration starts clearing out of the mind. So it can be just about some little practical thing. But it can, of course, be so much more profound. This is how I've been doing myself and getting so confused and it's been so painful. You realize, well, I can stop that. We start to see, actually, this experience I thought was just solid and painful and tight is conditioned. And in this moment, I can generate wholesome conditions on which it arises. I can put down the unwholesome ones. So I'm not arising on worry, I'm arising on resentment. I'm arising on compassion, on wisdom, on insight. This is our possibility. this is what, you know, in this little sutta I referred to, and the Four Noble Truths, and all the Buddha's teachings he's pointing to. That it's actually possible. People are waking up all over the place. You know, a little bit, a big bit. You know, you don't have to sit there for 100 years and then you deserve to wake up. It doesn't work like that. In every moment we put forward this effort, we cultivate. You know, who knows when the water jar is full. So it's to keep that kind of heartfulness in the practice. It's like, wow, this is really radical. You know, you don't need any fancy gear. We need to develop the faith that actually it's worth doing. And that's what our friends are for. Yeah, that it's really worth developing the capacity for presence, and then it fruits. I was coming to Seattle, yeah, and what was really lovely was to see Mount Rainier. I'd been here and never seen it sometimes, yeah? You guys lived here all winter, I think, and didn't even know you had a mountain, yeah? And you just realize, well, the mind is like that, isn't it? We can live in Seattle, and if you came in the winter, and people would say, it's ringed by beautiful mountains, you'd say, that's a load of rubbish. I can't see any mountains at all. Yeah. And then conditions change, the whole thing clears, and you realize, actually, the mountains were there all the time. They didn't have to be created. Just the obscuration had to clear away. This is what we're talking about. You know, these beautiful mountains, you know, that the capacity of the mind, the mind that's completely freed out of stress, worry, confusion. Mind that no longer is bound by ill will and resentment. Mind that just doesn't go there. Yeah, and each of us, as we cultivate, we start to ask, oh, yeah, it may not be completely liberated, but actually something happened and I didn't respond in the same way. The stability from the meditation and the clarity from my practice means actually, I saw the mind wanting to go that way, and I just brought it back. We've developed the capacity to do that. To start living our lives from a place of freedom rather than habit and confusion. Isn't it wonderful? I guess the older I get, the more I feel just so grateful that we had this, that we were given this teaching, and that it's been held for centuries. And here we still are, sitting within the shelter of the Four Noble Truths. And the freedom that's possible in any moment. So, it's enough, because Jitendra and I really would like to be more interactive with you. But we could, a pair of us could riff on this for a year, I'm sure. Yeah, because within each, like within the breath meditation, there is the whole path, the cultivation, enlightenment factors, the spiritual faculties. That everything is there, and as you know, in any bit you pick up, the whole thing is there. So we could get carried away, or more carried away, but let's just have a stretch if you need to, and then we'll just respond to any comments, any things about practice you'd like to share into the group or talk about?
Any questions? Because obviously people are at different stages of practice, and especially someone might be very new to this. So, you know, we welcome all questions because it's instructive for everyone. So have a little stretch.
So please, any comments, any reflections from your own practice that, you know, you'd like to share into the community here, or questions? Yes.
Could you speak about the difference between desiring certain states of mind, for instance, as opposed to the cultivation of awareness? Just kind of playing with the words.
Sure. So the question was, could we say something about... I'll put this on the other side, it might help. Could we say something about desiring pleasant states of mind as opposed to... As opposed to the cultivation of awareness? The cultivation of awareness. Shall I start? Well, it's awareness that recognizes and knows when desire is present. Yeah? So it's awareness that recognizes all states that are present or absent, at least that we come to cultivate awareness. So part of coming to understand desire, wholesome desire and unwholesome desire, you know, is getting to know it in our own experience. So in one sense, one could say, you know, it's a wholesome desire to develop, say, pleasant... Are you talking about meditation states? Pleasant meditation states? Because there could be the desire to develop pleasant states through, you know, drugs or nice food, you know, which is generally regarded as, you know, unwholesome in the sense of it's not going in the direction of nibbana. It's not evil to eat lovely food. But if you're wanting to understand the mind in terms of cultivating awareness, you can cultivate awareness watching desire, for example, for pleasant food, even as you're eating pleasant food. And you can even explore, is this really pleasant? Where's this sensation of pleasure? Where's the idea of pleasure? Because the funny thing is, if you're eating some food that's really pleasant, or you think is really pleasant, if you keep your awareness with it, that pleasantness disappears quite quickly. You know, it's only maintained by the idea, this is pleasant, and the generation of I want more and going for the next bite. But actually, if you stay with the actual process of eating, the taste passes very quickly, and then it's just quite mechanical mastication and swallowing. But the pleasure seeking is already into the next bite, right? It's not present at all, it's generating a propulsion to go forward, and in fact the seeking misses the experience in many ways. But seeking pleasant, using desire, if there's desire for pleasant meditation states, in one sense we could say this is wholesome, because it might make you sit down for half an hour or an hour and or study some texts and how do I become peaceful. So that's all wholesome in some sense. But really, when we discover in meditation, this kind of desire ultimately becomes a bit of an obstacle. So as the mind becomes more refined, it needs to shed different layers of even what seems like wholesome desire. You understand? Because it's taking us out of the moment, it's not necessarily being with what is. Do you understand what I mean?
So even desiring wholesome states of mind, that there is that bridge to the future.
Yeah, the desire can often take us away from deepening into the pleasantness of meditation here and now. Because actually the pleasure comes from letting go. And it's one comes to learn that when you understand the way when you practice with meditation and working with the mind, the more you let go and relax into the present, the more the pleasure and the what's called piti, which can be light rapture or it can be an ecstatic rapture, comes. And this is described in the Buddha's teachings. But that's not the final stage. That also, if one doesn't grasp at it, that also relaxes and takes the mind into a deeper equanimity, which actually is even more pleasant, but without the rush kind of thing. So, but if one latches onto that even subtly and desires more of it, it just takes you out of the moment, and we're conceiving something, we've hung on to something, we've identified with something, and it taking us already in a direction away from the possibility. So this is the perpetual lesson in meditation, as Tanya was talking about the breath, the letting go, the coming back, the letting go of what takes us away from this moment and resting into this moment in meditation is the natural deepening. The mind naturally refines and separates out as water and oil, as they say, separate out. So the mind, the things of the mind and the movement of the mind separates out quite naturally, or as again the body of water or a glass of water, if there's some silt in it, is stirred up, but if it's left, it settles out. And then you come to understand the more subtle movements of desire and where it leads the mind and whether it's helpful or not helpful. You might have some more to say.
When the Buddha talked about some of the pleasurable states of meditation in terms of being a raft or a way of something that can support us to practice, but they actually have to be let go of. And I work with it myself energetically, yeah? So,
sorry.
Did you get all that?
So, I was saying that the sense that these pleasant states of meditation, there's something that can be helpful to an extent, but the Buddha talked about them, that they actually, in the end, they have to be let go of. And if we think about it as an energetic, one of the first instructions for certainly mindfulness of breathing is to sit down with legs cross-legged, body upright, and mindfulness established in front of you. And what energetically I have a sense of is it's a bit like we're here, we're perpendicular, and if we start desiring pleasant states, we start leaning forward, yeah? So we've actually come out of alignment. We've come out of alignment, as Jitendra is saying, with the present moment. So it's about, can we actually just rest back into the understanding that the Buddha had under the Bodhi tree, that it's just here and now. Yeah. So when I see the mind kind of poof, just moving forward with wanting something, moving back, not wanting that, you think, yeah, but the whole process is about coming into the upright mind, the alignment. And it's, for me, it's easiest to feel energetically. So then it's the letting go of this movement and just relaxing it. And what you find even in deeper meditation is the relief of letting go even of the inclining towards the pleasant. To just come into what's actually happening. Because there's a stress in this leaning, isn't there? There's a kind of, it's much, you know, and there are lovely places in the suttas where the Buddha sits, talks about, oh, this is peaceful. The sense of letting go of these, even the pleasant states, this is peaceful, this is sublime. Because in the end, it's not about states at all. It's about the mind coming in to presence itself. And the addiction to pleasant feeling can pull us out. Yeah. So
it's interesting because you're asking also the difference between desiring pleasant states and cultivating awareness. Yeah. Is that the question? And so the cultivation of awareness is, I find, and may not be the same for anyone, but I find it's inherently pleasant. When I can bring awareness to bear, I find there's a sense of release already in that much, and release or relaxation is pleasant. And it's part of the path of practice to recognize when the body-mind relaxes and experiences more refined pleasure. Yeah? And with meditation states, the Buddha said, you know, cultivating that process, which actually leads to more refined meditative pleasure, is wholesome. It's a wholesome thing to do. It actually brings a path to fulfillment. However, any attachment, and attachment's natural along the way, but you find you have to learn how to let go of it along the way as well. And that's attachment, but also conceiving of it in terms of me and mine. So it keeps the mind open, very open, so that it can feel pleasure or pain. You know? And ultimately, Ajahn Chah, who's one of the meditation masters of our tradition, said, really, in this sense, pleasure and pain is of equal value. Because they both come and go, because the real value is in seeing, is having insight into the impermanent nature of feelings. Both pleasure and pain are of the same value. When you truly recognize the impermanent nature and the not-self nature of feeling, of all the five aggregates, then the deep insight release truly occurs. And the Buddha, it's worth saying, said Nibbana is the highest happiness, but it's the happiness of non-clinging. So there's a few stimulating ideas within that.
But it is easier to have insight into pleasant states than deeply unpleasant states, for some reason.
The mind's a little more. It depends, doesn't it? It very much depends.
That, you know, I mean, why the Buddha takes us through this beautiful process of anapanasati, which is a kind of deepening, refining, in a way, a pleasant feeling. Because, in a way, it's easier to stay really, really pleasant, present with something that's not extremely painful. It's easier in a way, unless it's too coarse and arousing, but with subtle pleasure, you can have more insight into it. So it's, you know, so you see in the Anapanasati, you go through this process of, firstly it's the coarse, the kind of bells feeling of pity, you know. The mind's really excited, and if you're new to it, people find they're going all over the place. Yeah, but that naturally settles into a sense of well-being, kind of bodily happiness. And all of these, and then that can settle into a sense of tranquility, equanimity. And all of these settlings mean that there's a more deeper and deeper capacity to look clearly. Until the mind gets really, really quite subtle and refined, and the kind of awareness, the mind itself starts to shine forth. It's the the kind of outward going knowing, as Pasakaki would call it, is put aside, and there's the kind of inward understanding. Does that make sense?
Is the end result to release suffering? Is that always the guiding question?
But it's tricky because any of us practice, we know first stages of meditation practice, you think you're going crazy. And you start to see all the ways you've been unskillful and all the kind of madness of the mind. It can be very disheartening. In a way, we're getting more refined and we're still caught in habits and stuff. So it's a bit like when you're learning to play an instrument. When you begin, you go bang, 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 and it sounds all right. And then you start to get your ear in and you can hardly bear to hear yourself play. It sounds so dreadful. Yeah. And then you keep practicing and then it starts to get so you can better hear your own music and it's starting to get better. And it really feels like that for me with meditation practice. There seems to be a stage where we can just hear how badly we're playing. You know, in the monastery, a certain stage, the kind of young ones coming in would come up and say, "I'm getting so much worse." Yeah, so it can feel different. Yeah? We can't just go by, "Oh, it's getting less suffering." It can be we're starting to see just what's really been going on, and that could be quite raw. Yeah. Oh. Yeah, and then we start to get more skill with that. And everything starts easing up. We start to understand how to play the guitar. Yeah. And we can make beautiful music. Yeah. Had a question?
Mindful of everything in people's experience, so we start off with breath. And in people's experience, the two things that seem to flavor the most are thoughts and emotions. And, you know, on the one hand, then you'd say, well, be mindful of those thoughts and emotions equally with the breath. But on the other hand, you sort of say, but return to the breath. So I'm really kind of balancing, because it's hard to, have continuity of mindfulness without discordant thoughts in the way that you can have continuity of mindfulness without breath. But at the same time, it also feels like you say, you know, go back to breath too soon, then you're sort of veering a little bit into tranquility, maybe, or it seems like that. I kind of have that balance between it. I wonder if you could address that.
It is a real balance in the end. You know, one learns a finer and finer balance. And it depends on your strength of practice. There is a choice. If you want to develop more stilling of the mind, you'll tend to just use the breath to keep stilling. So if you're getting waylaid by distracting thoughts, you come return to the breath, for want of a better phrase, more quickly, you know, just dropping, dropping, dropping. But if you're developing mindfulness of citta, like the third foundation of mindfulness, you might get more interested in this phenomena of distracting thoughts. And so you develop enough stillness, you still need enough stillness to begin to contemplate this appropriately, otherwise we just get run around by the thoughts and we're not meditating at all. So we still need enough stillness before we move on to contemplation of thoughts or mind states to really begin to see clearly their movement, particularly the arising, how they arise, how they affect the body, mind, and also what brings them to cessation. Or if we watch, they cease by themselves. So there's a whole, you know, body of contemplation to witness what's present and what's absent. So it's your choice, really. But I think for a lot of us as Westerners, we can get caught up. We get swept away by the thoughts, and we don't have enough stillness to make it a fruitful contemplation. So it's helpful, you know, you can come back to the breath and focus on stilling before opening up to the contemplation, or, you know, take it to whatever degree you feel comfortable with, but always being mindful that I'm not just getting swept along. There was something more I wanted to say about that, but it slipped away.
So, yeah, it is a balance, and I notice for myself that there does need to be enough stability, you know, that I'm not off in the proliferation, but that for what I can find really helpful and brings me back most profoundly is to notice the energetic underneath the thinking. So, you know, I have a, you know, worry would be the way my mind can go, and so I'll notice some thinking, I think, oh, let's just worry. So I just go, worry, and then I'm just back. So it seems to be, can I not be captured by the kind of voices, but actually recognize who's speaking? Yeah. So it's not to try and pretend that's not happening, but just to be really clear, this is worry, and if I realize the thinking's based in worry, I know that and there's no use in it. You know, what needs happen is the worry needs to be met, understood, and allayed. Because any thinking based in worry is just worry. You know, it's not clarity. Yeah. So, to me, I always try and come under the energetic of the thinking. If the mind just doesn't immediately return to the breath when I notice it.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And energetically, as you're saying, it's quite important that the breath is fully embodied. You have an experience of embodied breath, because it really helps you sense the energetics of the movement underlying or concurrent with the thoughts and the moods.
Mm.
And that one other thing I was going to say was this phrase, which we do a lot in the West, return to the breath, return to the breath. And I think we often get stuck in a struggle between what's happening mentally and this notion of returning to the breath, as if it's somewhere else. We've gone somewhere else and we must return to the breath. And it sets up this idea of a, you know, space-time separation somehow. So I've found it helpful in terms of an embodied experience to recognize what's happening. So let's just say thinking. Thinking, fantasizing, you know, about tomorrow, what might happen tomorrow. Instead of thinking, return to the breath, you know, because you're already present, you're recognizing thoughts as thoughts. You can just ask the inquiry, there's two different ways. Can I breathe with this just as it is? So you're not moving away from your experience conceptually. You're not getting rid of it and returning somewhere else. Can I breathe with this as it is? And what happens is obviously the thought disappears, the breath emerges, you've gone nowhere. And there wasn't an intention to put something down and reclaim something. It's just, or the other question is, where's the breath? So you're not moving it. So these inquiry questions I find, you know, specifically helpful in an embodied sense. Where is the breath? Or can I breathe with this experience as it is? And then you have a merging without this sense of struggle, putting something down and finding the breath again. So just explore that.
So the question is that Jitendra and I have referred to, you know, putting down, letting go of the unwholesome, and this saying, it's easier said than done, how do we go about it? So one thing I would say is that breath meditation practice is a practice in letting go. Yeah. So in a way we've been cultivating that in our meditation endlessly. A trillion billion times we've let go and come back. So for me that means that's kind of small muscle movement with things that there wasn't a really tight grip on. It was just easy, put them down, come back. Not that I've gone anywhere, but just feel the breath again. Let the breath be the thing that the awareness is resting in. But then when the bigger things hit, whether it's gone like that, the mind, and kind of taken a grip, I find feeling the suffering, the dukkha, is really the key for me. So that the action is not a rejection, it comes from compassion. Just feeling what it feels like when the mind is tight like this. Oh, wow. Boy, is that painful. And something in the compassionate heart starts to let things relax. So that's, a lot could be said, but for me it's really about, in a way we practice that with small things, but then when they're big, to just feel what it feels like to be holding on. Letting go happens by itself, but what does it feel like to be captured?
Yes, definitely. It actually takes a long time of practice to come to understand wholesome and unwholesome, especially without the overlaying judgment of right and wrong and good and bad and good and evil and all that, But wholesome and unwholesome, a lot of the Buddha's language is always in relationship to the goal of Nibbana, which is the cessation of suffering. So wholesome is that which leads to the cessation of suffering. Unwholesome is that which increases suffering. And this is something we experience directly in this body and mind. We're encouraged to understand what's wholesome and unwholesome within this experience, and to not to judge, but to inquire into it, to see it clearly so we can understand the process. And just as exactly as Willa was saying, when unwholesome is inherently painful. In some levels, we're so familiar with different ways of being, it doesn't get questioned. We don't even consider another way of being. But when we are involved in an inquiry into our experience, we recognize there are other ways of being, and subtly working with that is what brings fruit. And this is where we understand karma as well internally, the laws of cause and effect. How do I relate to something, an unwholesome thought or an unwholesome desire, unwholesome whatever it is, how do I relate to this? Because we can relate to it with more unwholesome thoughts, like you're such an idiot, flagellation, and that's just unwholesome and unwholesome, and we all in the West, we tend to get caught in guilt trips a lot. This is an example of an unwholesome mind state that's not helping anyone, but first of all yourself. But to understand, say, regret, when we've done something we've realized has hurt someone or hurt ourselves, it's a natural response in a clear mind to have a feeling of regret just for a moment. And that's very instructive. That's very instructive. And the idea, that's a wholesome mind state in the Buddha's teaching, wholesome regret or remorse, because it's instructing us oh, the way I behaved was actually didn't result in anything good. It made me suffer, made the other suffer. If we take that lesson, well, what do we naturally do? So, oh, I don't want to do that again. That hurt. It's like sticking your finger in the fire. We learn, oh, don't do that. That hurts. And that sounds very childish, but it is that level in the mind that we learn, that wisdom arises. And when we know that, this is the ripening of wisdom in the heart. When that's a very conscious experience, we don't tend to go there again. So the mind naturally, as I was saying, when it senses unwholesomeness arising, again, might naturally feels the heat, and then it just drops it, doesn't go there. You know, so this is a gradual learning, or it moves away, because what's the point of suffering when we cannot suffer? So trusting that process, it's a very gradual learning for us, understanding our own mind. It's getting on. Maybe, is there any one last quick question or comment or thought?
When you go back to the breath, do you work with different ways of breathing, or just natural breath?
Just in this tradition in particular, we just work with the natural breath, however it is. We don't want to create more intention to change it. Having said that, other traditions might do intentional breathing and different patterns of breathing. Generally, that's not what we do. But you may find, as part of a helpful way to get into meditation or to let go of something, that a few intentional deep in and out breaths are really helpful. Because sometimes we get very caught in a very a tight pattern of breathing. You know, we're familiar with shallow breathing, and we almost have to re-educate this system that, you know, to really do a long out breath and a deep in breath. And there's a lot of neurological stuff in the nervous system that's connected in with those nerves that relax when we do that deep breathing. Gives messages to the brain, it's okay to relax. So explore it, but generally once you've relaxed enough to sit quietly, then let things be natural.
And in that, the breath will change, and the breath becomes so that it's naturally you experience it, fully filling the body. We don't have to do anything with it, it's just we start to recognize what breath really is. So, the natural breath, but it's about almost not about having to do anything to the breath, it's about kind of dropping the limiting perceptions we can have of what breath is. So the breath starts to reveal itself as of quite a different nature than we often talk about it as. Realize you had a question, but it's yeah? Yeah, just recognizing some people have things they need to be going home to. So, it's certainly lovely to come and spend some time here again, to feel a community. And I know how precious it is to have good friends in the Dharma, so lovely to have friends in Seattle.